This is What's at Risk on WBZ News Radio 1030 and WBZ.com with Mike Christian of Risk Strategies Company.
Hi, I'm Mike Christian, and welcome to a special encore presentation of What's at Risk. What are your thoughts about risk? Let us know at whatsatrisk at risk-strategies.com. Send us an email at whatsatrisk, one word, at risk-strategies.com. Tonight we examine the worlds of spirituality and risk with two very special guests. In our first segment, we discuss real-life intrigue, espionage, and terrorism in South Asia. Our guest is retired CIA officer and author of North from Calcutta, Dwayne Evans. We'll also examine the ongoing strife between India and Pakistan and its ever-expanding impact on our world. In our second segment, we'll talk to Dr. Howard Cutler, co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness. In these troubled times of economic hardship and international strife, The Art of Happiness is perhaps more timely than ever.
Underneath the city and all that we possess, I met the Prince of Beggars in a place with no address.
He had air-conditioned shadows. He had $1,000 suits. He had hands to pour the brandy. He had hands to count the loot. He said,
I know what your game is. You are falling like a star. Heaven to Calcutta. Did you think you'd fall so far?
Beginning with Ian Fleming, who all but invented the genre, the very best spy novelists have been insiders who served as intelligence officers before they turned to writing. The greatest of them all were also game changers, like John le Carré, whose Spy Who Came In from the Cold rescued the spy novel from the light entertainment category and turned it into a hard-edged, gritty, reality-based literary form. Dwayne Evans' North from Calcutta begins with a firefight in a remote valley deep in Pakistan's northwest frontier province, and then roars ahead, pedal to the metal, until a nuclear holocaust has been averted and the world, at least for a while, is once again safe from fanatical Islamic extremists.
If you ever get to Calcutta, say hello if you notice me near. I might as well go to Calcutta. Oh, you certainly don't need me round here.
Evans' prose is honed to the bone readable. His understanding of the history and cultures of the Pakistan, Kashmir, Afghanistan conflict zone is both profound and informed by the years he lived there while working for the CIA. And last but not least, he's a gifted storyteller.
Won't you look for me in Calcutta? And I'll wave as I climb up my rope.
You know in your turban you won't look suburban.
Yay! At least I won't feel like a dope. You're gonna chase me off to Calcutta. Unless you tell me you love me, I hope.
Most Americans don't have a clue what South Asia is like, but it absolutely fascinated me, and I wanted to put a spotlight on the region, hoping in some small way I could educate Americans about the people, the culture, and the problems of the region, says Evans. While North from Calcutta is set in India and Pakistan, the interwoven plot themes take readers to Washington, D.C., London, Abu Dhabi, and Bangladesh.
Bangladesh. Bangladesh, where so many people are dying fast, and it sure looks like a man. Never seen such distress.
The storyline, enriched by fascinating characters, not only unveils the mindset and methodologies of an intelligence officer, but also reveals the attitudes, thought processes, and activities of Islamic extremists who are caught up in the religious and geopolitical struggle between Pakistan and India over the disputed territory of Kashmir. Dwayne Evans is a former CIA officer with operational tours on four continents, including duty as chief of station, which is the CIA's most senior field position. He is the recipient of the Intelligence Star for Valor. Prior to joining the agency, he was a U.S. Army Special Forces officer. We are speaking with Dwayne Evans, the author of North from Calcutta. Now, while you were working for the CIA, you lived in the region that you write about, Pakistan and Afghanistan. What is the history behind the India-Pakistan conflict over Kashmir that you write about in your book?
Basically, it grew out of the partition of India in 1947 when the British pulled out. And India was divided into essentially two countries, India and Pakistan. Pakistan itself was divided also into East and West Pakistan. And Kashmir at that time was actually controlled by a Maharaji. It was considered a princely state at the time. And just due to a whole lot of circumstances that occurred, this Maharaji, who actually was not Muslim himself, but ruled over a majority population of Muslim, he decided to essentially join with India and join the state with India. And that is the seed of the problem of Kashmir, in that it was a majority Muslim nation or state that joined with India and not with Pakistan. And Pakistan contends that it should have been, a state that went to Pakistan, since it's a majority Muslim country, and not to India.
What do the people in Kashmir think about that?
Well, good question. I think you get different answers. Some folk actually believe at this point in time that it should be its own state, an autonomous region, if you will. Then you're split. There's some that do believe they belong with Pakistan. Others believe that they should be part of India. And Kashmir is actually split itself now. Two-thirds of it is part of India, and one-third is now under Pakistani control.
That's interesting. But no part of it is Hindu, like India, obviously.
Well, there are undoubtedly Hindus that live there, but the majority of the population is still Muslim.
Now, the hero of your story is a Muslim, an operative for the Pakistani Intelligence Service. Spy novel heroes, at least from my experience, are usually, Brits or Americans, and not generally from another part of the world. Why did you focus on someone like Tareq Durrani?
The reason I did that was the main motivation I had in writing the book to begin with was to basically to try to tell a story about the region that illuminated the region to Western readers, particularly in the U.S., who might not know very much about that region. And I got the idea back in about 1994-95 time frame, and I thought, well, how in the world can I go about doing that? What do I know about that I can somehow bring this region to light? And the only thing I really know about, to any great extent, is intelligence work, intelligence operations. That's what I've done for my career. And so I decided I would create this character who is a Pakistani, not an American or a Brit or whatever, but someone from the region who is westernized just because of his particular upbringing in his case. But that way I could keep the focus on that region and on those cultures that are there and on those problems of the region, all those things which I wanted to bring to light in my book.
Now, since 9/11, we as Americans obviously get a lot of information about Pakistan and Afghanistan. Do we really have any concept of the complexities associated with that region?
I think we do have a concept. It's certainly at our policymaker levels, they have certainly, if they didn't before, I think in the last 9 to 10 years or so, have gotten a good understanding of it. But it is complex, it is difficult, and that is the problem we're facing. It's just not something that lends itself to easy solutions. And so that's really why this has become a kind of a long-term problem for us.
From, the everyday American perspective, and I realize our leaders and our policymakers probably have a better sense of the region, but from my perspective, and I hear a lot of information and I hear that it's complex, but what's the essence of what makes it so complex, that region?
Well, I think there's various things. You have the different ethnic and tribal groups that inhabit the area. You also have the different religious groups that inhabit that. You know, we got the Muslims, which are, of course, are divided into the Shia and Sunni, and you have Hindus as well as Sikhs that are there. You're talking about India as well as Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, all those countries. So it's a very complex mix. It's had a, you know, there's been a colonial history to it that's had an impact on it, that had an effect on some of the developmental problems that have happened there in terms of some areas were developed more economically perhaps than others. So you've got economic disparities within the region. So there's just a whole range of problem sets there that are still percolating along.
And they're almost not countries, really. You know, they're drawn out as countries, but in terms of how you have to deal with them, it's really more tribal in nature, as you said, right?
Well, it's tribal in some places. In other places, it's ethnic, and other places, it's religious. If you look at India again, when it was divided into India and Pakistan, Pakistan being in two different wings, actually, that in the eastern wing of Pakistan ultimately became Bangladesh in 71. It had a war of independence, in which India actually intervened in that somewhat. So Pakistan lost, you know, about a half of its country, so to speak, in that war. And I think that's one of the things that's probably not fully appreciated is the damage, if you will, to the national psyche there of having, first, Kashmir was something they were very, and still to this day are, very focused on and believed should be part of their country, and they didn't get it, or well, they got one-third of it. Then in 71, they lose basically half of their country, becomes an independent country from them. So I think there's a lot of nationalist sentiment there that plays into this, aside from the religious overtones of some of the conflicts there.
The Eurasia Group ranked the India-Pakistan issues as the eighth highest risk in the world for 2010. An excerpt from their write-up about this conflict is as follows. The decision by Pakistan to go after terrorists domestically provides Islamic extremists with powerful reasons to expand asymmetrical attacks on Pakistan's urban centers and to try and reignite the Indian-Pakistani conflict. That's easy enough to do. Pakistan's extremist groups have increased in sophistication and consolidated their capacity, both by joining together and by forging closer links to Al-Qaeda in the region. In Pakistan, a significant proportion of the population continues to believe that terrorist attacks against the population originate in India. This means that the likelihood of attacks in India and against Indian targets in the region is increasing, a particular worry given the nature of the potential targets, government facilities, and densely populated urban areas. Meanwhile, any new attacks would put serious pressure on India to take a tougher line on Pakistan. India's Congress Party leadership is loath to escalate military tensions with Pakistan. But following a quieter line after the Mumbai attacks in late 2008, it made strong demands on Pakistan to take decisive steps against the extremist networks with ties to India. Worst case, should there be a series of terror attacks in India, we could see Indian efforts to secure international sanctions against Pakistan and potentially surgical strikes by India against military training camps inside Pakistan. In short, for the first time in nearly a decade, there are serious factors pushing the Indian and Pakistani governments back toward confrontation.
My Shangri-La beneath the summer moon, I will return again. Sure as the dust blows high in June, moving through Kashmir.
Here with Dwayne Evans, author of North from Calcutta.
Is it fair to say that you've infused your novel, North from Calcutta, with a sense of reality based on your background in the CIA.
Yeah, that was one of my other goals in writing the book. I wanted to put an authentic flavor to the story. I wanted it to be not some James Bond story, but something that someone reading it could actually believe. And because of the nature of the work is interesting, I felt that by being authentic, I wasn't going to cheat any readers. I felt that the work itself is very exciting, and so by writing as close to it as I could, as it really is, I thought it'd make a good story, and that's kind of was one of my goals, was to write an authentic story about the life of an intelligence officer, in this case a Pakistani intelligence officer, but I think it carries through to any nationality in terms of the nature of the work.
Do you think your character is strong enough to be a character throughout a series of novels into the future?
Well, I've gotten some readers to suggest that, and they like the character, and I've had people suggest I need to write a sequel. That's to be determined. I haven't decided yet if that's the way I want to go, but I think he could. I think he definitely could. Right now, I know there's a lot of focus in the press on the Pakistani Intelligence Service, the ISI, Inter Services Intelligence Directorate, which he is a member of, a fictional member of. And in his case, again, he's westernized, because having been raised in the West. So he has a different spin on his character than perhaps the conventional ISI officer might. But I think having that kind of character allows the Western reader a way to better understand some of the dynamics at play in Pakistan than they would if I wrote him as just a straight Pakistani with no Western orientation.
I'm sure there's no easy answers to this next question, but do you think Pakistan and India can ever resolve their issues?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. But you know, it's going to take a while. When you consider that, you know, they became two countries in 1947. That really isn't all that long ago. And as I mentioned before, there's some serious things that have happened in that short history that have had a lasting impact. And I think, given that, it's not something that we can expect to happen overnight, and it's going to take a lot of diplomacy and a lot of confidence-building measures to reach that point where they can actually resolve. And I think the central issue here is Kashmir. The problem is you've got so many other players involved that have influences on that, such as the Lashkar-e-Taiba that carried out the attack in Mumbai. You know, when you have elements like that are able to intervene and create problems between the two negotiating parties, it really makes a difficult situation, because attack like a Mumbai can derail everything, and that's what happened last year when those attacks occurred in Mumbai. The peace talks that were going on, negotiations over Kashmir, kind of were derailed at that moment.
And speaking of those attacks, I think I read someplace that you had actually predicted those before they happened. I know you referenced it in your book, and you wrote that before it actually happened. Did you have some sense of it, or?
Well, the truth is, if you look back in recent years, in fact, you know, the LET or the Lashkar-e-Taiba, you know, they've attacked India in 2001. They attacked the Indian Parliament, are believed to have been behind that attack, and then both 2003 and 2006, they carried out major attacks in Mumbai as well. These were attacks, one of them was on a train attack that killed dozens of people, and they've carried out attacks in, you know, New Delhi, Jaipur, a number of places. So it really wasn't so much a prediction of something new that would happen. It was just looking at what had already happened and saying, okay, there's probably going to be another attack. They've had some major attacks in other cities, and so I just predicted that there would be another attack, although I did not predict in my book that it would be an attack. I did not say in my story that it would be an attack in Mumbai. It's actually an attack in another area. But they did use similar means of carrying it out in terms of a boat out of Karachi using satellite phones, some of the technology they use, and that sort of thing. That is similar, but the actual target was different in my book.
You reference in your book there's an aspect of it that involves a potential nuclear attack with small nuclear weapons. Do you worry about terrorists being able to effectively use nuclear weapons in an attack?
Absolutely. I think everybody should be worried about that. And that, of course, makes, again, the whole South Asia area of incredible importance to us, because, as you know, Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Right now, they are believed to be secure, I guess, and that's great, but it's a volatile place, and things can happen, and so that's got to be on everyone's mind, given all the things that are going on in Pakistan and that region in general. Keeping those weapons safe has got to be, you know, a number one priority for everyone.
Why do you think we can't find bin Laden?
Well, I think he's hiding very well. He's, you know, it's all the things you've heard about before. He's probably in some very rugged territory. Very few people know where he is, and so I think those circumstances make it difficult. He's one person. I do believe that we will find him one day. I think that someone along the way is going to make a mistake. Somebody who protects him will make a mistake. And when they make a mistake, there's a lot of people out there watching, and you know that'll be picked up on. And you know, I think we will find them. It's just going to take some more time, but it's going to happen.
Osama has been hiding for 6 years. Think about it. That's a good hider, people. That guy's a great. Like I can't hide for more than 6 minutes. This guy's doing it for 6 years. Osama's like the Michael Jordan of hiders. Think about it. I bet you, coming out of high school, he was voted most likely to hide. Right? Like, I bet you as a kid, whenever he was going to play hide-and-seek, the other kids were pissed because he knew the game was going to take forever. Right? They'd be like, what, you let Osama play? The game's going to take 6 years, you know. Okay, fine, go hide, I'll count. One, two, we're going to miss our high school graduation. Three, four, he's so tall, how does he do it? Five, six, he's just going to hide in a cave again. Seven, eight, and put out the videotapes.
Seems amazing with all the people looking for him and all the people in that region, and I realize they're very protective of him, that, you know, someone hasn't cracked at some point.
Yeah, well, it could happen at some point, too. That's the thing. You know, tomorrow somebody could decide, have knowledge of it or suspect something and bring that forward to appropriate authorities, and that could lead to his being captured or killed.
How do you think we as Americans can better understand the Muslim perspective?
Well, I'd say, one, read. Find books on the subject and read up about it. I'd say, you know, there's programs now on television quite often that go into it a bit. Find the Muslim and talk to them is another way. But we need to, the American public, I think, has become much more educated about Islam. However, I worry, and that's another reason I wrote my book and had a Muslim as a hero, you know, I worry that Americans are going to think that the Muslims are all terrorists, which is nonsense. In fact, my bottom belief is that this whole struggle that's going on right now with Islamic extremism, it will be settled by Muslims, not by us. And we need to keep that in mind, that we're, you know, they're going to need our help and support, but ultimately they're the ones that really are going to suffer if extremism takes control in their, wherever they happen to be, whatever country, and it's going to be Muslims themselves that are the ones that are going to resolve this.
And I do think your book is something that leads to having us have a better understanding of the Muslim perspective. We've been speaking with Duane Evans, the author of North from Calcutta. Is there a website, Duane?
You can go to www.northfromcalcutta.com, and the book can be, you know, purchased at most major stores through Amazon or, you know, major outlets.
Time for a CBS News update. We'll be right back with more What's at Risk.